Today is November the 18th, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, Twitter, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Microsoft plans to update your Windows 10 PC whether you like it or not. If you haven't hit the update button on your Windows 10 PC in a while, then you might find Microsoft will soon be doing it for you. It seems the Redmond firm can't wait any longer for some users to switch to its very latest operating system. Those affected by this automatic upgrade will be anyone who is still using Windows 10 version 1903 on their PCs with this aging software no longer being supported by Microsoft. Microsoft has now started informing users of the change and the news that they will be forced upgrading computers without need any permissions. This news shouldn't come as a shock, with Microsoft announcing earlier this year that it would be ending support for Windows 10 version 1903 on December the 8th, 2020. In a post on its website, Microsoft said Windows 10 version 1903 will reach the end of service on December the 8th, 2020. This applies to all following editions of Windows 10 released in May of 2019. Although some Windows 10 updates have famously caused issues for users, with some seeing broken printers and the dreaded blue screen of death, it's still a good idea to keep your PC up to date with all the latest releases from Microsoft. By regularly hitting the upgrade button, your devices should be kept free of any cyber threats, and you'll get the latest features. As the firm explains, in Windows 10, you decide when and how to get the latest updates to keep your device running smoothly and securely. When you update, you'll get the latest fixes and security improvements, helping your device run efficiently and stay protected. To stay up to date, select Start, Settings, Update and Security, Windows Update, Windows Update, and then select Check for Updates. If a feature update is available for your device, it will appear separately on the Windows Update page. To install it, select Download and Install Now. Cable companies will no longer be required to give 30 days notice on channel blackouts. The FCC has approved a rule change saying that cable operators will no longer need to give customers 30 days notice before a channel is removed from a cable package. The wording now says that cable operators must give customers notice of the loss of a channel as soon as possible, rather than notice of the loss of a channel specifying 30 days. The FCC acknowledged last month that programming rights sometimes come down to the wire, making it difficult for cable operators to know so far in advance whether the channels will be removed due to failed negotiations. The 30-day notice rule has only applied to cable operators, not streaming services. While we've seen streaming services give advance notice of changes to channel lineups, we've also seen distribution disagreements be resolved in the final minutes before a contract expires. Without the 30-day rule, the FCC says operators should notify customers without delay when the operator is reasonably certain it will no longer be carrying the programming at issue, and if possible, before the programming goes dark. When approving the change, FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel wrote in a statement, "Today, we update our rules for the real world," she says. "We determined that instead of a strict 30-day notice of a dispute that could lead to a loss of programming, it is better if consumers are just notified that a blackout is likely as soon as possible. This is a modern approach, and it has her support. But one word of caution, this decision speaks at length about burdens on companies, but she said she believed the guiding principle here should be updating our policies to the benefit of the consumers. In the end, I think the changes we make here do just that. However, if they are put in practice in a way that shortchanges consumers, we will need to revisit this approach. The commissioner did note that the 30-day advance notice should still be given when changes to programming are within the cable operator's control and when there will be a change in rates. The order still states that notices should include the precise amount of the rate change and explain the reason for the change in readily understandable terms. Google Photos will end its free unlimited storage on June 1, 2021. After 5 years of offering unlimited free photo backups, Google Photos will start charging for storage once more than 15 gigabytes on the account have been used. Users will be capped at 15 gigabytes of free, high-quality photo storage per account. It is noted that the existing storage is only unlimited for high-quality accounts. That's not original quality files. Google has been compressing photos and videos as part of its unlimited storage program. This change includes Google's Drive storage programs, counting Google's workspace documents and spreadsheets against the same cap. Google is also introducing a new policy of deleting data from inactive accounts that haven't been logged in for at least 2 years. If you have been storing legal or regulatory documents that are required to be kept greater than 2 years, move these files to local storage. All photos and documents uploaded before June 1st will not count against that 15 gigabyte cap, so you have plenty of time to decide whether to continue using Google Photos or switching to another cloud storage provider for your photos. Only photos uploaded after June 1st of next year will begin counting against the cap. Google points out that it offers more free storage than others. You get 15 gigabytes instead of 5 gigabytes that Apple's iCloud offers. So Google will maintain its advantage. For heavy users, a new alert system will help you stay aware of your free storage limit. Google offers a personalized estimate to help users determine how long their storage will prove sufficient. To help save space, Google Photos will incorporate tools allowing users to easily find and delete blurry and dark images. Google Photos will include new storage management tools, such as one that helps you locate photos you likely don't want to keep long term. This tool will help you review what you want to keep and help identify what you might prefer to delete, like dark and blurry photos or large videos. Pixel owners will still be able to upload high-quality, not original photos for free after June 1st without those images counting against their cap. It's not as good as Pixel's original deal of getting unlimited original quality, but it's a small bonus for a few people who buy Google devices. For users needing more than 15 gigabytes of storage, Google will be promoting its Google One membership. If you want to continue to use Google Photos for your photo and video backup needs and need more than 15 gigabytes, plans through Google One will start at $1.99 per month for 100 gigabytes of storage. Why the change? Well, today more than 4 trillion photos are stored in Google Photos, and every week 28 billion new photos and videos are uploaded. The service now includes a free VPN for Android at some of its higher tiers, and it seems as though many Google products are aligning with Google One. The service, in order to be available, needs to be sustainable. Google One pricing is not changing. It starts at $1.99 per month for 100 gigabytes and has tiers going through 200 gigabytes for $2.99 a month and 2 terabytes for $9.99 a month and all the way up to 30 terabytes for $149 a month. Alongside photos, Google Docs, Sheets, Slides, Drawings, Forms, and Jamboard files will also begin counting against storage caps. If you haven't touched your Google account for 2 years and don't respond in any way to the multiple warning emails and notifications that Google sends you, the company may delete data from your account. If you're inactive in one or more of these services for 2 years, Google may delete the content in the products in which you're inactive. Similarly, if you're over your storage limit for 2 years, Google may delete your content across Gmail, Drive, and Photos. They will notify you multiple times before they attempt to remove any content, so you have ample opportunities to take action. The simplest way to keep your account active is to periodically visit Gmail, Drive, or Photos on the web or mobile while signed in and connected to the internet. But don't expect Google Storage to be your one method of backing up. The following is a point-counterpoint whether employees work from home should pay a privilege tax. This was based on Deutsche Bank research notes. Employees who choose to work remotely should pay a tax to help those workers on low incomes who cannot, said a research note from Deutsche Bank. According to the research report titled, What We Must Do to Rebuild, and employees who work from home receive immediate financial benefits, including reduced costs for travel, food, and clothing. The report suggests the employer would pay the tax if it does not provide the worker with a permanent desk. Otherwise, the employee would pay the tax. They said, our calculations suggest the amounts raised could fund material income subsidies for low-income earners who are unable to work remotely and thus assume more old economy and health risk. Based on a global head of fundamental credit strategy and thematic research at Deutsche Bank. On an average salary of $55,000 at a tax rate of 5%, Deutsche Bank estimates the average person would pay more than $10 a day in tax, and that would raise a total of $48 billion a year. The report says the tax should only apply outside times when the government advises people to work from home, as has happened during the pandemic. The tax should also exclude low-income workers and the self-employed. As the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the United States, many businesses required employees to work remotely to stop the spread. As the practice has become normal working during the pandemic, more employers appear open to allowing remote work even after the pandemic has passed. Deutsche Bank estimates the proportion of Americans who work from home during the pandemic surged to 56%. The sudden shift to work from home means that, for the first time in history, a big chunk of people have disconnected themselves from the face-to-face world, yet still leading a full economic life, said researcher in the report. That means remote workers are contributing less to the infrastructure of the economy while still receiving the benefits. Well, there is a disagreement with that from The Guardian. They're saying employees shouldn't pay to work at home. On a suggestion that workers who continue to stay away from the office should pay more tax, it is, sadly, all too predictable that the economic research unit of a bank should suggest that employees working from home should pay more tax, when the lion's share of savings from this arrangement are in fact made by employers. Staff who work from home after pandemic should pay more tax? No. While there is a brief mention that this tax could be paid by companies that do not provide workers with a permanent desk, this seems to be an afterthought. In this report from Deutsche Bank, so one-sided that it ignores the fact that many employees have had their salaries cut in the pandemic, assumes that all employees spend money to get to work, and ignores to get to work by cycling or walk, ignores the additional cost of heating at home or lack of space for family. Does it not consider the significant savings that companies will make if they reduce the number of desks that they provide? Well, is this more about property owners getting worried about empty space in cities? Let's change our cities for the better, convert empty office space to homes, and take our cities back for the people. Once a study is made, people can latch onto it, and before you know it, there may be a tax imposed on those who work from home. Government has many new ways of coming up with revenue. The acronym SETI, S-E-T-I, stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a collective term for scientific searches for intelligent extraterrestrial intelligence. For example, monitoring electromagnetic radiation for signs of transmissions from civilizations on other planets. Are we alone? SETI Institute scientists are working to find out. The number of potentially habitable planets in our galaxy is close to 100 billion. Most are far away. But other worlds that could have life are, even closer, Mars, and several of Jupiter's and Saturn's moons have environments that could support biology. Beyond our solar system, there are so many planets, it's reasonable, mathematically, to imagine that at least some are populated by intelligent beings. SETI Institute researchers look for both microscopic and macroscopic life using a variety of instruments and strategies. Rovers, orbiters, field expeditions, and radio telescopes are just a few. Understanding where biology may gain a foothold and detecting its presence is the goal of these scientists, and they hope to establish whether life is commonplace or rare. The SETI Institute has more than 100 research scientists investigating the nature of the universe and the prevalence of life beyond Earth. The Planetary Society's involvement in SETI practically began when the organization was founded in 1980. Just 1 year later, NASA and the Society funded Suitcase SETI, a portable spectrum analyzer that could be installed on a large radio telescope like Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. Suitcase SETI eventually grew into Sentinel, an all-sky search using a 26-meter radio telescope at Harvard University. The Arecibo Observatory had its origins in an idea of Professor William E. Gordon from Cornell University, who was interested in the study of the ionosphere. Gordon's research during the 50s led him to the idea of radar backscatter studies of the ionosphere. The observatory was built between mid-1960 and November 1963. William E. Gordon of Cornell University oversaw its design, who intended to use it to study the Earth's ionosphere. He was attracted to the sinkholes in the karst regions of Puerto Rico that offered perfect cavities for very large dish. The observatory also produced detailed radar maps of the surface of Venus and Mercury and discovered that Mercury rotated every 59 days instead of 88 days, so did not always show the same face to the sun. American astronomers Russell Hulse and Joseph H. Taylor, Jr. used Arecibo to discover the first binary pulsar. Well, what happened was a second cable failed at Arecibo with the antenna causing even more damage to the famed SETI dish. Another cable has fallen onto the reflector's dish at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, and yet another frustrating setback for this beloved facility. The main support cable of the Arecibo Observatory failed and fell into the dish on Friday, November 6. The extent of the damage is not yet known, but the dish was damaged further, as were some nearby cables. Good news was no one was hurt, but a safety zone had been set up around the facility as a precaution. With two failed support cables in 3 months, it's imperative that response teams now find a way to stabilize the structure. The first incident happened on August the 10th of this year, when a 3-inch thick auxiliary cable fell onto the observatory's main reflector dish, creating a 10-foot-long gash. The reason for the failure has yet to be determined, but the auxiliary cable appears to have slipped out from the socket. This doesn't appear to be the case for the main cable, which simply snapped, possibly a result of extra weight imposed on the remaining cables. According to the observatory officials, they were aware of broken wires on the main cable, and engineers were scheduled to make emergency repairs this week. Like the failed auxiliary cable, the main cable connects to the main support tower. The incident from this past August also resulted in the damage to the Gregorian dome and the platform used to access the dome. The facility at Arecibo is managed by the University of Central Florida on behalf of the U.S. National Science Foundation under a cooperative agreement with University Enterprises, headed up by Ana Mendez and Yang. The observatory director, Francisco Cordova, said in response to the latest incident that this is certainly not what we wanted to see, but the important thing is that no one got hurt. We have been thoughtful in our evaluation and prioritized safety and planning for repairs that were supposed to begin this week. Now, this. There's much uncertainty until we can stabilize the structure, and it has our full intention. We are evaluating the situation with our experts and hope to have more to share soon. The response team will try to reduce the tension in existing cables by installing steel reinforcements, something they like to do as soon as possible. The team is also hoping to expedite procurement of two new support cables currently on order. These plans could evolve over the next few days as the situation is assessed further. Progress at the Arecibo laboratory has been slow since the August incident, as officials struggle to pinpoint the cause of the auxiliary cable failure. The failed socket, for example, was sent to NASA for a forensic analysis. Arecibo officials had previously asked the National Science Foundation for funding needed to make temporary repairs, but the projected course of the repairs is not yet known. The observatory was built in the 1960s, has a long history of fiscal uncertainty. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, 5S Made Simple.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is when we get down to business. This is when we talk about computers from the standpoint of the IT professional. That would be, yes, me. I have been doing this for a long time, and along the way, I've learned a number of different things. One of the things that I did kind of, I'll say, unintentionally for a number of years when I was a field technician, but then as time moved on, I became more intentional about it. Now, don't get me wrong. A clean desk is a sure sign of a sick mind. I'm going to open with that. I will tell you that for papers and some of that stuff, I have not really achieved the grandiose idea of Kaizen and really 5S, which is a subset. It's a type of methodology in regards to improving, in regards to being better at your job. But as far as tools, as far as working with tools, I am meticulous about this subset of Kaizen, which is, it's referred to as the Toyota way. It comes from over in Japan over the course of the post-World War II era when they started to work really hard at becoming better and more efficient at a number of different things. So we look at 5S, this 5S methodology, which goes like this. Sort, set in order, shine, standardize, and then sustain. So I was working on a knife, which I had to replace a part with this pocket knife. And I had ordered the part, but I was realizing how much that I really focused on this particular area in regards to my tool set. If I open up my tool set, I will tell you that I could almost blindfolded put my hand on any different screwdriver or particular ruler or implement within that tool set just by reaching out and picking it out, just by grabbing in the right area, blindfolded, and I would know where it is. And sometimes there are tool subsets which get a little bit more intricate. In this case, I've got one right here. And if I pull out one of these sections, it comprises of the handle for the screwdriver, and it has three different sets of bits which go into the screwdriver. Some of these are security bits. Some of these are regular bits. Some of these are like Phillips or regular screwdrivers. And some of these are Torx bits. And I will tell you that all of these Torx bits are in order. I can tell you right now, without even glancing at the top of the head, T4, T5, T6, T7, T8, T9, T10. Those different bit sizes are all in the right spot. So if I go and I need the T8, I can just go there, pull that T8 out, and it's already there. So everything is already sorted. It's already reduced down to the particular location that it's supposed to be, the different sizes. And it's already set and order. So those are the first two S's, sort and set and order. And we don't realize this, but if we keep all of our tools in that kind of condition, we've all gone out to the somebody's garage. And they've got a brand new looking tool chest. And you open up the tool chest and it looks like it's a trip back to the 1940s. There's wrenches strewn about and screwdrivers of all kinds. And yeah, there's seven different Phillips screwdrivers. They're all the exact same thing, the exact same length, the exact same head, the exact same handle. How did you even do this? They're all made by Stanley. You at 5, 6, 7 different times, you've gone out and you've bought screwdrivers, the same screwdriver. You don't need to do that. So you may have seen this in some of the different car shops you've gone to. All of the tools have a place and all of the places have a tool. They've got it all sorted out. There's a little frame around it that you can only pull it. You can look at this board. And you can see that, yes, this is a screwdriver of this particular length that goes right here. This is this ratcheting head gizmo. This is this. This is that. It's all right there. They've gone through. They've sorted it. And they've set it in order. And the next item, shine. Every time I finish with one of my screwdrivers, I clean it off. I carry around in my tool chest, in my or box, whatever you want to call it, I carry around as many of the, a couple of different types of cloths. I've got a microfiber cloth in it. I've got a number of the blue shop towels. You know, think like Bounty, the quicker picker upper, but like seriously solid. I carry those around. I carry around latex gloves because I go through and I make sure that everything is shiny. Everything is clean. I put back my tools in the right spot every time. And then I standardize too. Everything is basically all of the screwdrivers off on one side and all of the different, hammer type implements. They're off in a different area. All of the measuring items, they're in a different area. And it's a matter of I've got a standard work set for all of this, but also I try to make sure that I get the same things from the same manufacturer. And then, through all of this, we keep it all together. We sustain it. So there you go. I give you a quick little version of what happens and what we should do. And we should be trying to do this throughout all of the areas of our lives. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. How cost-effective is your internet service? Are you getting the best bang for the buck? States that pay the most and the least for internet in 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic have made many Americans more reliant on affordable internet connections than ever. While we can't visit loved ones or participate in activities, we usually enjoy the internet. Keeps us connected, but just how cost-effective is the internet we rely on so much? And how does it differ across the United States? The data analysts at HighSpeedInternet.com compiled proprietary data points from 350,000 internet users across the United States to see how much each state pays for internet service. They analyzed this data to find the average monthly price for internet service in each state and further broke it down into average price per megabits per second to better highlight the differences in cost among different states. To build a nationwide comparison, they broke down states' average internet cost by megabits per second. And do you want to know how much you pay per megabits per second? Divide your advertised internet speed by your monthly bill. If you don't have your plan information handy, run fast.com and use your result from that. States that pay the most for internet are Wyoming, North Dakota, Montana, and South Dakota. They all pay over $7 to $8 per megapixel per second. Virginia, Iowa, New Mexico pay between $6 to $7 per megapixel per second. Pretty expensive. States that pay the least for internet per megapixel per second are Rhode Island and Washington, D.C., which cost them less than a dollar per megapixel per second. Massachusetts, Georgia, New York, California, and Maryland pay less than $2 per megapixels per second. For context, the average price of internet in the United States is $3.91 per megapixels per second, and the average monthly price is $48.25. You got the data, you could do your own calculation. They use per megapixels in their data set. They average how much each state pays per megapixel because it better reflects the value of internet service than ranking by average monthly payments. The latter doesn't take into account the balance between cost and internet speed quality. For example, California and South Carolina residents pay a similar average monthly amount for the internet plans, $45.43 and $45.47 respectively. But while Californians pay just $1.86 per megapixels per second, South Carolina pays $4.20 per megapixels per second, which illustrates how much better a deal people living in the Golden State gets. Rural states pay more. Urban states pay less. Their data shows that states with large rural areas tend to pay more per megapixels per second of internet than states with more urban areas. There are a few reasons that could contribute to this divide, including this type of internet available, internet speeds, and competition. There are a few different types of internet widely used in the United States. Certain types offer more bang for your buck, while others offer comparably slower speeds for higher prices. Fiber optic internet and cable internet tend to have lower costs per megabits per second, while DSL and satellite internet tend to cost more per megapixels per second. DSL and satellite are also the two types of internet most likely found in rural areas, because cable and fiber infrastructure are both expensive and usually confined to more populated areas. One of the reasons why different types of internet cost more or less per megapixels per second is because faster internet plans usually cost less per megapixels per second, and cable and fiber internet are faster than DSL and satellite. Available internet speeds range from 5 to 2,000 megapixels per second or 2 gigabits per second in the United States. While internet prices range from $15 to $200 per month, these prices increase as speeds increase, but they don't increase at the same rate of speed, so high-speed plans tend to cost less per megapixels per second. And, of course, competition is good for the consumers. Areas that give people multiple options for internet providers give people the option to comparison shop and go with the best deal. But a lot of U.S. population has access to only one or two internet providers, so they have to make do and choose whatever is available. Cities and urban areas tend to have more providers drawn to the large, dense population, so competition is better than it is in the rural areas. This year has thrown the unequal access to affordable, fast, and reliable internet service in America into stark relief against the backdrop of a global pandemic. The internet is our lifeline to work, education, healthcare, family, entertainment, and life in general. And while some internet providers lower prices and up speeds to help low-income households during the pandemic, those services are still mostly available in urban areas. Rural communities are still paying more for slower internet. Just take your monthly bill and divide that by the average megabits per second speed test that you get. With the work from home, people are looking into possibly moving into more desirable living areas, but this is one way you can determine how effective or cost-effective the internet will be when you move. Google's homemade processors could start appearing in Pixel products in a matter of months, and that could make a meaningful difference in the device's evolution. The notion of Google building its own custom chips to power its Pixel and possibly even Pixel Book products is something that could have a significant practical impact on all of us, and something well worth understanding. The subject of custom Pixel chips is top of mind right now for a couple reasons. First, there's that Apple event announcing that company's plan to bring its own processors into its Macintosh computing appliances. Google CEO Sundar Pichai hinted that Google's own homemade Pixel chips could be right around the corner. Pichai said Google was doing some deeper investments in hardware, some of which takes 2 to 3 years to come together. In 2021, some of those deeper investments will come into play. Axios reported Google was on track to have its hopefully custom chips finished and ready to ship in a Pixel phone by sometime next year, and then in a Google-branded Chromebook at some point later down the road. Google making its own Pixel chips could very much matter and have a meaningful impact on those of us who use the devices. It gives Google complete control over what exactly is included from the moment Google first started selling its own self-made Pixel phones. There have been talks about how Google can control vision of the way Google wants Android to be experienced. That was a sharp contrast to the Google-branded Nexus phones that preceded the Pixels. Those devices were actually designed and created by other companies, usually relying on one of their own finished phone models as a base and then incorporating some of Google's requested tweaks and modifications. Google's Nexus phones always had compromises relating to the fact that they were basically just customized versions of some other manufacturer's existing product. The Pixel then was Google's evolution from that setup, one in which it had only a tiny amount of control over the total experience, to one where it had almost complete control over every aspect of the phone. But there was still one important asterisk: the chip. Those processors inside our devices determine a lot about what sorts of functions the gadgets can and can't support. Processors are what provide foundational support for standards like 5G. They provide the framework for tons of different camera functions, biometric authentication systems, fast charging capabilities, and even artificial intelligence-related features to operate. As it stands now, Google is dependent upon companies like Qualcomm for giving it that framework and determining much of what it can do with its Pixel products. And for a company that's laser-focused on areas like machine learning and an always-listening assistant service that creates some serious limitations with the types of experience it's able to provide. By creating its own custom chip for Pixel phones, Google could shatter those boundaries and gain the freedom to do exactly what it wants, how it wants, and what it wants. In other words, turn the Pixel into a fully, well, almost fully, self-control machine. A singular device that represents Google's vision for what a current Android phone ought to be, and as the company that also creates the operating system, Google's in a unique position to take advantage of that power and wield it in some potentially interesting ways. There is a significant benefit a self-made Pixel chip could bring about and allow Google to pass down to us. It provides Google total power to decide how long the processor, and thus the phone around it, is supported. Android upgrades have long been a sticking point of the platform, mostly due to the plain and simple fact that device makers have no motivation to make timely and ongoing updates a priority. Google alone has that incentive to offer a level of upgrade timeliness and reliability. Part of the problem is that Google currently has to rely on the vendor that makes its phone's processors to continue supporting those chips and making sure every new Android version plays nicely with them. And the chip makers, understandably, are much more interested in hawking their moderately improved new models every year than supporting their aging wares. So at a certain point, it becomes difficult for Google to get beyond that and keep providing updates for its phones. Building its own chips eliminates that problem. That's how Apple is able to keep sending out iOS updates to iPhones for so long. What is Google, first and foremost? A cloud service company, one whose services ultimately support its primary money-making business of online advertising. That's why, unlike every other Android phone maker, Google is in a position to benefit from providing you an exceptional Android phone experience that only continues to get better over time. While Samsung or LG have the underlying goal of getting you to buy more hardware, since that's how they make most of their money, Google mostly wants you to use its software and services and be online as much as possible. And having its own chip in a Pixel would be much better aligned with that goal. The Pixel gives Google a newfound ability to cut back on costs and potentially, well, pass them down to us, the consumers. All outward benefits aside, building your own components bring with it one very important advantage. At least when the process is done properly and at a high enough scale, it translates into dollars. Think about it. Everyone is there to make money. So when Qualcomm sells Google the processors it needs for its Pixel phones, it's marking them up from the actual cost in order to burn a profit. That's basic economics 101. Well, when Google becomes the company creating all the chips, it no longer has to pay that markup. It sells the processor to itself, in a sense, at cost. And that means it can pack more value into a Pixel phone or Pixel book. All that's left to do now is wait and see when exactly Google's Pixel chip plan comes into place and how exactly it ends up looking. But it sure seems like some interesting possibilities are ahead. Presenting Marty Winston with his segment on home automation, Put UVC Next to Me.
Oak Ridge National Labs did a supercomputer analysis of not only COVID-19 itself, but also a map, an actual map, both geographically and across time, of the spread of the pandemic and other factors that you might not think related, just to find out if they did relate. Well, the guy at the head of that initiative spent 45 minutes on the phone, and we covered a span of related topics and info. There are some new tech countermeasures against the pandemic that are coming over the next few months, some in a few weeks. And some of the pricing is down to just a few $100. But you'll also hear about some of the ways UVC product builders make claims about their effectiveness that you should question and why. Still, put UVC next to me, and that's the name of this report. It all starts with understanding how it gets from an infected person, let's think of that person as Toxic Tony, to a person who's in danger of getting infected. Call that person Vic Victim. One other element to this is understanding that so far there isn't anything short of you being dead that can completely prevent you from getting COVID-19. So this isn't about absolutely stopping it, unstoppably blocking it, or anything like that. This really is about shaving your odds, loading the dice, setting things up to make it less likely that you'll get infected. Hey, if we all cut those odds by maybe 5%, we'd flatten the curve and might see herd immunity by Thanksgiving next year. Make that 10% and we're clear by late summer, even without a vaccine. Now, interested now? So, if Toxic Tony is too close and sneezes or coughs right into Vic Victim's face, there's no way out, especially if neither one is wearing a mask. Know what masks are really about? Well, imagine you're holding a candle at arm's length. Can you blow it out? Well, yeah, if you blow hard enough. Now, put on a mask and try again. That candle keeps burning. The mask reduces the forward air pressure coming out of your lungs. There's still just as much air coming out, but it can't go long. It has to go wide. Exhaling or coughing or sneezing with a mask on sends less air straight forward, but more leaks out the edges and goes sideways, or even backwards, curving around your neck. Without a mask, there's almost no sideways or backwards blow. With a mask, there is. And that's where social distancing figures in. Or will, anyway, in a second. But first, you need to know a little more about how the virus travels. First up, it can't fly. It hitchhikes. Mostly on droplets like the spittle in your coughs or sneezes or even normal exhales, but also sometimes on small particles like dust. It uses those mini goobers as its Ubers. So as those go shooting out of Toxic Tony's mouth, they're not immune to the law of gravity. They travel a little like a dandelion puff, riding air currents until they finally drop. How far can they get before they drop? And how much do they have to drop before they're not likely to infect you? Great questions. A two-part answer. Let's talk about Vic Victim for a second. If Vic isn't wearing a mask, inhaling can suck in air from a fair distance away. If Vic is wearing a mask, the bubble of inhaled air is much smaller. It's the same thing you saw in thinking about blowing out that candle, only in reverse. One more point, and one that you don't hear about very much. When COVID-19 is in the air, it's the air at the level of your nose, or as much as a foot higher, or as much as a foot lower, but basically at the level of your nose that is most likely to get you infected. Once more, the virus is most likely to ride in at the same height as your nostrils, plus or minus a foot. So, if both Toxic Tony and Vic Victim are wearing masks and are either both sitting or both standing, and their nostrils are at about the same level, well, the odds favor the COVID virus dropping out of that inhale zone when they're 6 to 8 feet apart. Sound familiar? But if only one is wearing a mask, you can triple that, and double it again if neither one has a mask on. So masks do a lot to cut the odds, and social distancing does a lot to cut the odds. But then what? When two people both wearing masks are 6 to 8 feet apart, that does a lot to avoid infection, but there are two ways to dramatically shave those odds in your favor. And they both have to do with tech that keeps the COVID-19 coming from Toxic Tony from making it all the way to Vic Victim. And they learned about one of those ways from airplanes. The air pressure outside a plane can get extremely low. That's why airplanes pressurize their cabins, right? The ventilation aboard aircraft is part of that and tends to blow straight down. You've been there. Here comes the cool part. They looked at the data and discovered that the pace of infection between adjacent passengers on airplanes, this was when they were skipping seats, the pace of infection between adjacent passengers was dramatically lower than any place else. On analysis, it's that downward thrusting ventilation air. It forces COVID-19 in the air to drop below the inhale zone so quickly that infection rarely happens. Maybe never. It could be that the few infections that did happen didn't happen on the plane. Don't know. So an air curtain, abrupt downward airflow. An air curtain can help you avoid infection, but only if it happens in the right place and at the right speed and so on. In real life, you probably move around a bit more than you can in an airplane seat. Complicates that. Happily, there's a second way to stop those COVID-19 hitchhikers. Kill them before they get there. Okay, yes, that's going to be a UVC thing, but first, two quick detours. One is the science of it, and a correction to what you initially heard here. You know those little golf tee-shaped fingers on the COVID-19 virus? You get infected when one of those touches certain areas in your nose and your mouth. Officially, in your nasal and oral cavities. Those are the areas rich in ACE2 enzymes. And the touch of that virus finger triggers a bradykinin peptide storm that brings on the infection. It's not a team effort. It just takes one. More than one is also a thing. It's called virus loading. Stand by for that because there's an important twist when somebody is already infected. But let's start with Toxic Tony letting out a big, juicy cough. Nobody seemed to have real numbers here, so just spitballing. Sorry, no pun intended. Let's say that cough makes travel arrangements for a million little virus hitchhikers. If you stop 99.9999% of all those viruses, one still gets through. You'll see devices boasting about being 99.9 or 99.99% effective. Nothing gets everything, so think of that as a lot better than nothing. When you cut the number in the air, you cut the odds of inhaling one. Now, there's a $3,500 unit out there that pulls air from behind it, disinfects that air, and blows it toward people. If you're sitting next to something stinky and a fan is blowing at you, it might thin out the stink, but you'll still smell it. Their theory is that by thinning out the ambient air with virus-free air, it's somehow reducing your odds of getting infected. Logically, that feels like Dropping into a pit with 500 rattlesnakes is somehow safer than dropping into a pit with 2,000 rattlesnakes. We asked to get one of those for testing and review, but it isn't here yet. Most of the freestanding UVC countermeasure products we've seen tend to spec their coverage in square feet or cubic feet. And when you think about it, both are ultimately ridiculous. We're slowly talking vendors into using a radius of impact, how far from the air intake it's pulling pathogens out of the air. The least expensive UVC gizmo we've seen is from Bosky, B-O-S-K-I, priced at less than $250. Its radius of impact is, 2 or 3 feet, but that's great for placing by the head of a crib or on a nightstand or between students at a library table or in other places between any given pair of people. And this is important. If somebody where you live has tested positive, every time that person exhales, that person is exhaling live virus right into the air, where it's easy to then inhale and get reinfected. The more virus attacks that person suffers, that's called loading, the worse the infection and the longer it lasts. Remember, you need a radius of impact to reach you at the height of your nostrils, and its exhaust should blow away from you and downward. That's the clearest buying guide you can ask for. One more time. Nostril high, blows down, between pairs of people who all wear masks and are all socially distanced. We've seen some products that are about to launch with 6 to 10 foot radius of impact zones, good for a salon or a small waiting area, good for an elevator car. The trend toward modestly priced devices that share our spaces is one that deserves your attention. So repeat what you heard here before. Put UVC next to me. Next time, it's the night before Thanksgiving. So how about a report that you'll be thankful not to miss? Save the wishbone for the kids and give us, if not your thanks, at least a listen.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information on how to join the teleconference, visit the website of the computer club. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on Tech Talk, Friday, November the 20th. Starting time is 8 p.m., and they will meet via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The Princeton PC Users Group will meet Tuesday, November the 24th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom. Their website is ppcug-nj-apcug.org. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on holiday tech gift gives, and their meeting that was normally scheduled on Thanksgiving Day has been rescheduled. It's now Thursday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on their normal meeting date that landed on Thanksgiving Day was rescheduled for Thursday, December 10th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom. Their website is pcug.com. New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, December the 10th. Meeting time is at 7 p.m. via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 11th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of this program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, And on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.